Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Marissa Ann Bass. She is an associate professor of the history of art at Yale University. We're talking about her latest book, Insect Artifice, Nature and Art in the Dutch Revolt. Marissa, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, this is mostly, although it's about many things, this is mostly about the work of one artist, Joris Hufnagel. I'm going to mispronounce that because I could never get the hang of the subtlety of a lot of Dutch pronunciation.
The Dutch artist names are a real chore, but it would be Hufnagel if you were doing it
right.
The Dutch way.
You don't give a hard G. And his collection called The Four Elements. But before we go further, this is not just a regular book. Describe what this is.
Well, it's a really, I think, beautiful book in the sense that it's a partial facsimile of these manuscripts that are housed today in the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., and are never on view. Almost never, no one gets to see them. And so it's designed to have a book with many layers. On the one hand, it gives people the ability to hold these manuscripts in their hand and to flip through it, at least part of these very rich manuscripts.
And they're done to size, right?
And they're done to scale, and so you can, in the middle of the book, you can open it up and see these kind of beautiful facsimile pages, and I am so grateful to my editor at Princeton Press for making it so gorgeous.
It's stunning reproduction.
Yes. So that's at the core of the book, but then it's really a story about why somebody in the 16th century, in a moment that was very politically and spiritually turbulent, chose to devote himself for 30 years to studying the natural world, and particularly insects, at a time when there was no systematic study of that body, that sort of animal kingdom. And so it's really kind of exploration about what makes somebody get this kind of obsession and what drives somebody to turn to nature in a moment of political turmoil and upheaval, and how. So it's a story of his life, but it's also the story of a moment in history that I think has a lot of resonance with the present.
I think it does, too. We're talking about he lived from 1542 to about 1600, I think is the date.
He died in 1600.
But the time period that he's living through is we can't even imagine how complex and disturbing this was. Talk to me about what's going on politically in the Netherlands now at that point in time.
Absolutely. So, you know, the Netherlands as we know it today was not yet constituted in the 16th century. The Netherlands became the Netherlands as a result of a revolt that took place against Spanish imperial rule in the region beginning in the middle of the 16th century and resulted in the breaking off of what is now Belgium from what is now the Netherlands. Hufnagel was living in Antwerp, which is now in Belgium, which if you go today is a great fashion capital. But in the 16th, wonderful, you know, design and you know, shopping. But it's also, I mean, the 16th century, it was really the kind of commercial center of Europe, even though it's not a city that we think of that way today. And so he's living in a commercial heartland. This war really is what destroys Antwerp's economy and leads in the 17th century to the rise of Amsterdam and the Dutch Golden Age because trade had to go move northward and elsewhere. And so the revolt resulted in a divide between the southern Netherlands, which ultimately ended up staying on the Catholic side of things, which of course was the religion that the Spanish King Philip II wanted the Netherlands to adhere to. And then the northern Netherlands, where many Protestants emigrated, became the new commercial center in the 17th century. So Hufnagel's living in this moment of transition. He starts his career as a merchant. He becomes an artist almost out of necessity, even though, you know, his early biographers describe his passion for art from an early age. So it's, I think, this really complex story of somebody who's responding to a very rapidly changing world, economically, politically, in terms of, you know, the war that's happening with this foreign power, and spiritually, in this ongoing sort of the ongoing aftermath of the Protestant Reformation and hitting the Netherlands in the later 16th century.
There's so many interesting threads to this story, and I want to bring up a few. We can't possibly talk about them all. Metamorphosis,
yes,
is an important idea for people like Hufnagel at the time. And we're talking specifically about Ovid's Metamorphosis. Talk to me about why that would seem to be a key text for these people to latch on to.
Yeah, that's a great question, Mark. I have to say, I have loved Ovid's Metamorphosis ever since I read it first.
Me too.
I mean, who doesn't love reading Ovid? It's fantastic. You know, when you... the first time one reads Ovid, one tends to think about it as a story about myths, but it's as much a story about myths of, you know, gods and nymphs transforming from one thing into another as it is about the natural world. Mm-hmm. He writes beautifully about the kind of way that transformations happen in the natural world and how those relate to human history, and that is something that appealed deeply to Hufnagel and to many of his 16th century readers at a moment that was simultaneously a one of tremendous upheaval and turmoil, and at the same time, a moment when people were beginning to be interested in the you know, natural history and the kind of study of nature in an empirical sense. And so Ovid provides this kind of poetic language for thinking both spiritually, but also in a kind of devotion to detail about the natural world, I think. And this, and you see that Hufnagel is drawn to his text because he refers to Ovid's lines from Ovid many times throughout his manuscripts.
You write about the fact that people started to doubt the idea of human exceptionalism, that it was sort of like, no, what's really going on? Because you have all this violent change going on.
Exactly.
And nature's law of changes seem to be what the reality is versus this sort of more religious-based reality that people had talked about before about human exceptionalism.
Exactly, yeah. And Ovid also, I mean, he and I talk about this in the introduction to the book, you know, he opens with this famous line about how humans are the ones who are alone among the natural kingdom and had this capacity to look up and recognize what we would call now God. And the idea that somehow humans were special, that they were exceptional, it was thrown into doubt for the first time and in a very modern way, beginning in this moment in which Hufnagel lived. And that colors his approach and, I think, obsession with understanding nature as something that's larger than himself.
Well, let's talk about the four elements. Was this meant to be a single-volume book? It wasn't, was it?
You know, what it's meant to be is very hard to say, because this is one of the challenges for me as a scholar of Renaissance art, is you do not very often find artists sort of writing down, well, this is what I was planning to do, and then I did this instead. It would be nice if that happened. But it seems that, you know, that it was a project of long duration where he started, you know, studying nature, maybe without even an idea of making four volumes or even one volume. And it grew over time, and it grew to the point that it clearly is organized today into these four volumes. And the four volumes make sense because there was a fascination at this moment of interest in nature from all these different directions, a kind of empirical, spiritual direction, and spiritual direction in turn. There was an interest in the four elements and, like, how do these elements interact in the world? And there were lots of theories that were recovered from antiquity about that. So that structure places it in a in its particular moment, but it's, you know, how he might have continued to develop it over the course of 10 years, if he'd lived 10 years longer, is hard to say. My sense is really that, and I suggest this in the book, that it was a project that he never considered complete. It was a thinking project, a project that he used to think with over the course of his life, much more than it was ever meant to be a finished product. And I think that's something, you know, in the history of art, we often think about the masterpiece as this thing that is finished at the definitive endpoint, but that's not the way Hufnagel thought in his process of art making, which is also, I think, really fascinating.
And we're talking about the four elements. So it's ignis, aqua, Air and Terra. Aqua, he includes beautiful illustrations of things associated with water, snails, clams. Air, obviously birds. Terra, mammals. But why insects for Ignis? Fire.
That you have hit on a very curious question, Mark, because the element of fire was not traditionally associated with insects. It was sometimes associated, you know, in antiquity at least, you know, with creatures like the salamander.
Right, because they used to think that they started fires.
Exactly. I think that, I mean, that Hufnagel was interested in fire, to get back to this idea of metamorphosis, precisely because it's the most unstable element. It is the most transformative and ever-shifting, and also has both positive and negative connotations.
And they metamorphosize.
Exactly, and that works very well for insects, because insects can be things that are frightening and horrifying, and this was true in the early modern period as today, but also things that are beautiful and magnificent and mysterious. And so fire is, in a sense, the most all-encompassing element, and one that allows, you know, because insects really are the kind of, in the way Hufnagel structures the volumes, they are the ultimate destination. I mean, the thing that is closest to God, that is the most out of and the most out of reach of our understanding. And you see that as you look through the miniatures, that, you know, he starts with this very grounded elephant in earth, you know, who's swatting away gnats with his trunk, you know. And he's really annoyed that these gnats are bothering him. But by the end of the book, it's sort of the gnats have become the subject, and these tiny, seemingly insignificant things have so much complexity.
They're amazing illustrations to be able to hold in your hand, again, reproduced in this book, because the detail on them, especially when you get to the insects, is sort of alarming, because there's even shadow painted in of things like these dragonflies. Where he's actually taking the wings of the dragonflies and put them into the illustration.
Yes, that is one of my favorite things about the insect book, is this moment where he takes a real piece of nature and pastes it to the page next to a real insect wing next to a painted insect wing. And this becomes an obsession among Dutch artists in the 17th century as well. There's a famous still-life painter who is actually condemned for the fact that he was cheating by putting insect wings in his paintings. But that's clearly, I mean, Hufnagel wasn't cheating. I mean, he's setting up a juxtaposition where he's saying, you know, can I actually do this? Can I get as close to the detail that there is in nature? And when you see those pages, it's really striking that in a way that you can't, that even his incredible virtuosic skill, he was also very aware of his limitations. In that sense, both extremely ambitious and extremely humble as a creator.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Marissa Ann Bass. She's Associate Professor of the History of Art at Yale University, and we're talking about her latest book, which is sumptuous. I think that's safe to say. Insect Artifice, Nature and Art in the Dutch Revolt. Let's talk about your use of the word artifice.
Yes.
Talk to me about what you're intending the word to mean.
Absolutely. Well, artifice, in one sense, is a synonym for, you know, the mode of creating something, right? But it's a particular kind of creating. I mean, it has at its etymological root the idea of making, but it's a making that can be clever, but it can also be sly and devious. It's a kind of double-sided making, because when we talk about artifice, we could also be talking about, you know, somebody trying to get away with something and using artifice to do it, in addition to the kind of artifice that would be the most obvious to talk about in an art historical context, which is, you know, the process of making and the kind of cleverness that's put into it. Hufnagel really embodies both definitions of the word, in the sense that he is making art that is extremely learned and virtuosic. At the same time, he's also very cleverly disguising a lot of messages and ruminations about what's going on in his political context. And that's where the kind of ingenious, sort of slot darker side of the artifice comes in. And so the word appealed to me for use in the title For that reason, but also because insects are artificers themselves. I mean, they make webs, they make nests, you know, they create their own worlds as well that are also have those kind of two connotations built into them.
The big point is that you can look at this and go, wow, he's doing like an encyclopedia of natural history at the time. That would be missing a major point to his work, because it's not just that. There's all sorts of meaning to these that goes way beyond what the creature actually is.
Yeah, that's very well put.
Well, and this brings us to emblems.
Mm-hmm.
An emblem. What's an emblem book?
I love the opportunity to talk about emblem books on the radio.
Really? Emblem books, you need to get out more.
Yeah, they need to get out more. Yeah, exactly. I mean, in fact, we are familiar with what emblem books do today. It's just we don't recognize it as such. Instagram is kind of an emblem book in a certain way.
Good.
But emblem books were, you know, bestsellers, hugely popular in the 16th century. It's a genre of book invented in the 16th century that essentially combines word and image in dialogue. So you have an image usually at the center, sometimes you have a title at the bottom, and then a kind of poem or inscription below. And the idea is of an emblem is meant to make you think across word and image. So you read the title and then you look at the image, and maybe the image makes you think differently about what the text below says. And it's this totally interconnected and associative world. So it's a way of thinking at the junction of text and image, of image and text. Yeah.
Now Hufnarl did an absolutely incredible emblem book called Patience.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, that's done in what, red chalk?
Yes.
On paper?
It is, and it's huge. I was astonished the first time I went to see it. It's a huge folio book. It's like the size of an Encyclopedia Britannica.
Oh, wow.
Hufnagel was very drawn to this genre because, you know, and this is one of the reasons that I was drawn to write a book about him and his moment in the first place, because he was not just an artist. He was a polymath. Like, he was the true idea of what a Renaissance artist is, in the sense that he wrote poetry, he was learned, he went to university, you know, he was a merchant, he was an art dealer, he was so many things. And so emblems were perfect for him as a mode. His Patience album is fascinating because here he's using the emblem book as a format essentially to tell the history of the early years of the Dutch Revolt. And
right.
So he's talking about what
right.
happens to his merchant friends, how they're losing their fortunes, how people are being thrown out of their homes by soldiers.
And there's amazing illustrations. I mean, every page is a different form of patience. Patience in adversity, the patient
exactly.
soldier. And the soldier is... You know, it really is like about the occupation.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's really it's political reportage in the moment, which is something. It's an extremely unusual book in the sense for the 16th century that somebody's using drawing to report sort of his most recent experience, literally what had just happened to him and what he had witnessed over the past 2 years.
Well, you know, we forgot to mention that he had to leave Antwerp and actually spent years in other cities of Europe.
Absolutely. He had an extremely itinerant career. He fled. The story, according to his early biographer, is that he lost his family. He came from a very successful merchant family, and there's this wonderful story early in his biography where, you know, he is described as a boy doodling in chalk on the walls of his attic. And, you know, he loved making art, and then his parents wanted him to be a merchant, so he became a merchant. And then, you know, in one of the worst Spanish invasions of his hometown of Antwerp, his whole fortune, according to his biographer, was plundered and taken by Spanish soldiers. And so he fled initially to look for commercial opportunities abroad. He took some of his art with him and ended up getting employed as a court artist for some of the most important court patrons of the late 16th century, and who had some of the most important early collections, the sort of preambles to the modern museum at that moment in time. So he traveled for business, but then he also traveled for art and for job security.
I love learning about other things that he did. He would augment Book of Hours by painting in the margins, and you have reproduced several examples of that in the book. And first of all, that seems like a weird thing to do. It'd be like taking a work of art and go, yeah, that's a great work of art. Let me add to it. And I'm going to put some stuff on it. And it, to the point where he paints a fly that looks absolutely real with a shadow on the corner of the page.
Yeah. And I love that fly because he also paints it as if it's been smashed between
right.
the pages of the book.
Right.
It is a weird thing to do.
Were you taking up friends' versions of the book and then adding on to it and then giving it back to the friend?
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other interesting genre of
About friendship albums, right?
Yes. That is another one of my absolute favorite manuscript genres in the 16th century because essentially that you make this book and you start with a blank book and you pass it around to all your friends and each friend inscribes a page or sometimes multiple pages. Maybe they draw a picture. Hufnagel did that in his friends' albums. And you end up with this collection, a kind of personal history of people you know, your colleagues, your close friends. And they're really fascinating things.
So were any of the pictures from the Four Elements used in friendship albums?
Not that I have ever seen. Friendship albums, you know, the Four Elements, the manuscript is quite small, actually. It's really almost on the scale of a friendship album, but friendship albums tended to be even smaller because they had to travel. So one of the goals of, you know, when you were making a friendship album was to have not only a really diverse network on display, but also to sort of show all the places that you'd been. So you have friends in Poland, and you've got friends in Italy, and that means they had to be really small. The Four Elements would make for some of the most resplendent images in a friendship album that I had ever seen. There are watercolor paintings in many friendship albums from the early modern period, but they tend to be a little more quickly dashed off because practically, if you were handed a friendship album to inscribe from somebody you knew, usually it'd be given a day or two.
Oh, okay.
You wouldn't get to sit with it for a month because, you know, the person would have moved on by the time you had finished.
We should mention, by the way, we're talking about the Four Elements. That's a watercolor that he used.
Exactly. It's watercolor and gouache on parchment.
Yes.
Gouache being an opaque version of watercolor. But it's also, and this is one of the hardest things to see in the reproductions, is he also used gilding and gold and silver gilding. So when you see the manuscripts in person, they actually shimmer.
And
some of the insects are touched with a material called gum arabic. And it gives them a kind of sheen. So particularly the beetles, when you hold the manuscript in person, you kind of tilt it to the side. It's suddenly like these things are coming off the page. It's really remarkable.
There's some. We're going to run out of time. There's some creatures in here that he has a jackalope in here.
Yes.
I thought that was something that they made up in the 1930s in the West.
I know. It's amazing when you get to the history of fantastical creatures, how far they go back.
So what's the story about this? I don't know. How old is the idea of the jackalope?
Now, you know, to be honest, Mark, I don't know when that begins.
So that needs to be your next book, like the history of the jackalope
or
in Western.
I would pass that on to anyone. I would read in an instant the history of the jackalope.
That's so weird that people, like, through the centuries have conceived of a rabbit with deer horns.
I know. And, you know,
well, it's antelope horns. It's antelope horns.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. But it's also one of the things that's fascinating about the moment of the beginning of natural history, right? Because as these people are beginning, you know, these scholars and naturalists are beginning to try to document for the first time the different species that they're observing in the world, they also feel a compulsion to document the fantastical creatures that people have been reading about since antiquity. And so those are all put in the mix together. And it's really, I mean, this continues into the 17th century.
But so much of his work is just really it looks like an illustration from a natural history encyclopedia. I mean, I can identify those species of dragonflies. I mean, he's got a stag beetle that was, I think, lifted from Albrecht Dürer.
But he observed it himself.
Right. He made it more anatomically correct than Albrecht Dürer. And
exactly.
There's a painting of an elephant beetle that he did that is like one of the most beautiful natural history illustrations I've ever seen.
They are. I mean, nobody really equaled his insects for, you know, until you get to somebody like Maria Sibylla Merian,
right,
the end of
right.
the 17th century. I mean, they are unparalleled. But it's also, you know, and those, they truly do look like, almost like they could be modern natural history illustrations in their accuracy. But in a way, it's deceptive because their intentionality is so different. And in the other volumes that are not the insects, he borrowed very frequently from
right.
printed images. So it's really a mix because he was willing to take, you know, some crazy fantasy creature like a locust, you know, that he saw in another illustration and include that alongside something that he, an insect that he, you know, had presumably carefully preserved, had on the table before him and was minutely studying.
Like the bees.
Mm-hmm.
The bees are absolutely stunning and done to scale on that page. And all the we got to finish up now, but every illustration is in this amazing oval.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a very interesting framing device. Also one that's related to some degree to the tradition of emblem books and sort of what's going on inside of the frame and how does that relate to what's outside of the frame? Because the other thing about the four elements is that it's full of text. Texts that Hufnagel collected that he associated with the insects and the animals and the fishes and the shells that he was depicting at the center of the page. So the oval is a kind of fascinating boundary that he plays with as well as a framing
wow.
device.
Well, what I took away from this is that when you're faced with a radically unstable world, this is in your own words, one of the ways to recuperate is to study nature. And make of it what you will. And this is an amazingly beautiful book. And great essays in this book, too. My guest tonight has been Marissa Ann Bass. She's Associate Professor of the History of Art at Yale University. And talking about her latest book, it's one of these amazing books where it's a beautiful art book, but it's great about history and also philosophy. Insect Artifice, Nature and Art in the Dutch Revolt. Marissa, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's been a real pleasure for me, too.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.